The role of war correspondents and the dangers they face has been highlighted in the current conflicts in Iraq and Syria.
Video showing beheadings of Western journalists by the group ISIS captured worldwide attention, and the absence of journalists in regions controlled by ISIS militants has created black holes of news coverage, according to the group Reporters Without Borders.
Lindsay Palmer researches the role of conflict correspondents. She's an assistant professor of journalism and mass communication at the UW-Madison. She joins us here in the studio. Lindsay, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what is the value of having correspondents in conflict zones like Syria and Iraq?
Well, speaking especially from an ethical perspective, and this is an area that I study here at UW-Madison, it is really not ethical to not have correspondents in the conflict zone. And that's because simply if we're trying to envision a world where the best practices, and this is thinking of ethics in its applied sense, where the best practices internationally can be achieved in terms of geopolitics, then we need witnesses at these sites. We need people there who can show the rest of the world what's going on. Otherwise, it'd be way too easy for these things to be covered up.
And I've read people referencing the genocide in Rwanda as an example of what can happen when you don't have that international witness out there.
Exactly. I think that's one of the cases that gets cited most often. And there are a number of others. Think about Syria in 1982 compared with now, where we have not only professional war correspondents, but so many of these digital activists collaborating with them and helping to distribute the images of what's going on.
And we mentioned those black holes in ISIS-controlled regions in Iraq and Syria, and that a lot of times the only video we might see from a place like that is filmed by ISIS itself.
Yeah, and I think this is a real problem and a real question for people working within the field of professional journalism, but also in media studies. And, you know, on one side, you can sort of argue that it's good to have some kind of image to distribute in order to incite debate. But on the other hand, there does need to be a balance, especially when the images that are being distributed are salacious and are sort of publicizing a horribly private moment of death.
So without reporters, all we get is propaganda.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Yeah, potentially.
Now, is the work, I mean, we've seen these beheadings. These are not the first cases of journalists dying while covering a conflict. Is the work they do worth the risks they take?
I would absolutely argue that it is worth the risks that they take. And I think that a lot of journalists themselves would probably agree. I've interviewed a number of war correspondents for the research that I do. And every single one of them has said that without this work, the world would not know some of the atrocities that unfold. So if a few individuals, or actually unfortunately more and more individuals, according to Committee to Protect Journalists, if they have to risk their own lives in order to get this information out, then they view that as part of their calling, and that should be valued.
Now, here in the West, we often focus on the Western journalists themselves. I know you've written about the role of local people, stringers or fixers, I guess they're called, who work with correspondents. Who are they and what kind of things do they do?
These people really need a lot more attention from the popular media, from the general transnational public. These are the people who often live at the site to which the foreign correspondent may travel. They arrange interviews. They do translation work. Sometimes they conduct interviews themselves. And sometimes they're sent out to do all of the reporting simply because Western journalists deem that reporting to be too dangerous, as is often the case in Iraq. So they can be anything from a translator or a driver of a car to a surrogate, in a sense. And this labor that they do is highly dangerous to them. And that's something that I think does need a lot more discussion.
Are they injured? Do they die in the line of work?
More of them tend to die than these Western correspondents that get so much FaceTime in the media. If you look at the statistics over the course of the last several years in Syria, the vast majority of journalists that are recorded to have died in Syria are actually Syrian, and many of them work as fixers and stringers.
Not to diminish the risks that the Western war correspondents take, but when their job is done, they can leave. And the stringers, the fixers, this is where they live. Do they often face risks after the coverage has gone away?
This is one of the main problems that the fixers and stringers I've interviewed have brought up with me, and that's the fact that they can, on a smaller scale, face a great deal of tension with families and friends who, if they end up finding out that they were working with Western journalists, don't like that information. And on a larger scale, they can be tracked by government officials who wouldn't necessarily strike out in quite so overt a way at the visiting journalist, but would charge the local journalist with treason. So it's a really serious problem.
So is there talk among media outlets and war correspondents about ethical responsibility toward these local journalists?
I think that the conversation is moving in that direction. There's certainly talk on sites like Reporters Without Borders and the Committee to Protect Journalists. But I think that it's really an area that needs far more discussion. And part of the problem is that journalists and their news outlets a lot of times don't like to go into detail about the level of collaboration that's involved in reporting. This is a problem also with stringers, with freelancers, especially freelance photographers who won't get credited for the work they do. So that's one problem. And then also this way of looking at fixers as though they're outsourced labor. And because of that, news outlets don't really feel that they're responsible for their safety, their contractual labor in that sense. So I think that that's something that really needs to be revised as much as possible.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, if you are a local journalist, driver, photographer, translator, you name it, you're not going to get much of the glory. It sounds like you're not going to get paid much. Have you heard much about what motivates people in this position?
Well, some of the people who I've spoken with have said that what motivates them is the possibility of eventually becoming professional journalists. A few others have said that they love the translative work. They like being able to kind of build that bridge between cultures. And then others do have the sort of political interest in the sense that they just want the story to be told in some way or another.
That they want to help bear witness and help the rest of the world know what's going on?
Yeah, they want to do their part in that witnessing.
Hmm. Now, turning back to the war correspondents from the West, you've talked to a bunch of them, and something I wonder is, I will probably never do something like this, but if I did, I'd think, well, how would I talk to my wife about that and my kids and explain the risk? Is this a conflict that they have, that they grapple with?
I think so. I mean, there's a great deal of this exact problem surfacing in the memoirs that you'll read by war correspondents and the articles they'll write for various publications, and of course also in the interviews that I've conducted. Some of them claim that really you can't have a personal life, that this has to envelop everything. And others have successfully been able to do this, but I think it maybe depends on the individual and the types of relationships that they build.
And this probably applies not just to conflict, but I've heard interviews with journalists talking about going back to Liberia for a second stint covering the Ebola crisis and trying to figure out, how do I do this in a way that doesn't put my family at risk?
Yeah, I think that it really isn't unique to war coverage, but it's very much an issue of putting oneself in some kind of risk. So even disaster reporting, going to report on natural disasters, that can be another problem like that.
So are there differences if, say, somebody works for a news network or BBC or New York Times versus, I know a lot of freelance reporters are out there trying to cover conflict zones?
I think the differences for freelancers is just the intense amount of competition that they face and the fact that they are rarely protected by those news organizations who will tell them not to go somewhere because they can't insure them, but then will reward them by buying their story once they go ahead and go. So there's just that lack of safety and protection that staffers have, I think.
And is there a sense that if the affiliated reporter is taken hostage or something or held in North Korea, somebody might help them get out. The freelancer has nothing like that waiting for them.
Yeah, that's generally the understanding. And I think that, on some level, there have been times when, for freelancers, their families and their colleagues have gotten together to try to help them. But the amount of pull that's involved is very different. We saw Richard Engel get kidnapped in Syria, and he was, he's an NBC celebrity, and he was able to get out of that situation. But then you see someone like James Foley and Stephen Sotloff, and the situation was very different for them.
So this is a potentially very risky profession. Again, you've talked to a lot of these war correspondents. Are there things about, I don't know, their personality that you've noticed that they have in common that leads them to do this?
Well, I wouldn't want to necessarily comment on their personality or their psychological makeup or anything like that. I can only go on what they've told me. And almost as a rule, I've spoken at this point with 54 different correspondents. And as a rule, they've told me that they are a misfit and that you have to be a misfit in order to do this kind of work. Or they've used the word maverick as well. So there's kind of this way of not identifying with the status quo that can be, in their eyes, both a good thing and a bad thing at the same time.
Briefly, we hear about cuts to investigative reporting funding, science reporting, environmental reporting. Is the same thing true with conflict reporting? Are there just cutbacks in what papers outlets will pay for?
Yeah, there's an amazing amount of cutbacks. I mean, we've seen the closure of foreign bureaus around the world, really starting even back in the 80s, and especially intensifying throughout the 90s and then the 21st century. And what's happening is that the correspondents themselves are being asked to do the work that entire news bureaus would have done before. We're also seeing the rise of parachute journalism, which has a lot of problems because of the fact that these people don't often know the language in the place where they're going. They don't have that much background. And they haven't had enough time to really know the story and understand what it is.
We'll leave it there for now. Lindsay, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's Lindsay Palmer, Assistant Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at the UW-Madison.